That order will not stand, but we are not going to throw rocks. Mueller did not respond. He was a master of silence. The president has authorized me to tell you he will cooperate, Dowd said. His words to me were, tell Bob I respect him. I'll cooperate. Mueller seemed relieved. What do you need? Dowd asked him. We'll get it to you, but let's get this investigation done. The president's position is that he has nothing to hide. He is not happy with the investigation, to say the least, but we want to avoid a protracted battle. But we'd like you to reciprocate, and that is, engage. John, Mueller said as he stood, the best cases are ones where we can fully engage. The reason we're cooperating is to get this damn thing over with, Dowd said. We're not going to assert any privileges. This is over the objection of Don McGahn, but the president wants to do it. He wants you to see everything. Talk to everyone. Ty Cobb had come up with a way to maintain, but get around, an executive privilege claim on testimony or documents. He had told Mueller, Bob, we're going to give it to you. We're not waiving the privilege. After you see it, and at the end, if you feel like you've got to use it, let us know, and we'll get you the waiver. As to the balance that's in your archives, you've got to return them with the privilege. Mueller seemed thrilled that he would see all the documents. Let's just do that verbally, said Mueller and Quarles. We don't want to create a lot of paper. Dowd said that was fine. No written record. John, Mueller said, you know me. I don't let any grass grow under me. Dowd, a veteran of special investigations, knew they could go on endlessly. The length of these investigations often became the abuse. Mueller said, Jim will be the lead for me. He'll be the deputy, but you guys can call me any time, and I'll see you. Great, said Dowd. Same here. You guys need something, call me, and we'll get it for you, or we'll answer whatever question or help get witnesses. The case that was being built, as reported in the New York Times and the Washington Post, had to be examined seriously. On alleged collusion, the questions included Trump's 2013 trip to Moscow, what he might have known about efforts by his former campaign manager Paul Manafort and his longtime attorney Michael Cohen to do business in Russia during the campaign, and what Trump might have known about other aides, such as Roger Stone's alleged role in Hillary Clinton's hacked emails. In a celebrated July 27th news conference during the 2016 campaign, Trump had invited Russia to publish the emails that Clinton's lawyer had deleted because he had determined they were not relevant to the FBI investigation. Russia, if you're listening, candidate Trump said, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press. He later tweeted, if Russia or any other country or person has Hillary Clinton's 30,000 illegally deleted emails, perhaps they should share them with the FBI. The next day, he said, of course I'm being sarcastic. Dowd thought that the declaration and request to Russia, sarcastic or not, hardly suggested hidden subterfuge to work with Russia that seemed to be the focus of the Mueller investigation. The major problem might be allegations of obstructing justice by urging Comey to drop the Flynn investigation and then firing Comey. But Dowd believed that the president's Article II constitutional authority clearly encompassed firing an FBI director. How Mueller might look at this would turn on the evidence of Trump's conduct. The key would be fathoming Trump's intent. Was there a corrupt motive, as required by the statute, in his actions to impede justice? In most cases, that is a high bar, and generally, prosecutors need evidence such as urging others to lie to investigators, destroying documents, or ordering the payment of money for illegal actions, such as buying the silence of witnesses, as Nixon had in Watergate. The thousands of hours of secret Nixon tape recordings provided an unusual clarity about the obstruction of justice or cover-up in Watergate. Dowd had found no Trump tapes or witnesses unfavorable to Trump other than Comey. At the same time, he had been a prosecutor. He knew the culture. Prosecutors like to make cases, especially high-profile ones. Inside the White House, it was obvious Mueller's Russian investigation was getting to Trump. Those who spent the most time in the West Wing and Oval Office found it was consuming too much of his emotional energy. It was a real distraction. Trump had a hard time compartmentalizing. Entire days were consumed by his frustration with Mueller, Jeff Sessions, and Rod Rosenstein. Even during meetings on policy issues that were Trump obsessions, like Chinese tariffs, he would bring up the Mueller investigation. Often it was about what he had seen on TV. "How is this playing?" he asked. "What do you think I should do to push back?" The staff in the meetings who were not on the legal team did not want to offer ideas. Trump rarely missed a chance to declare that it was unfair and a witch hunt. It was driving him crazy, Porter saw. It would ebb and flow, but there were times when Trump became consumed by it and would become distracted from the job and the business of being president. He felt it was unfair and he had done nothing wrong. There were people investigating him who seemed to have unlimited powers. Trump was worried about wiretaps that might have been authorized by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Porter told others Trump was very bothered by the possibility of FISA wiretaps in the campaign, a sense of sort of feeling violated, but that there was someone that had some power over him where he wasn't the top dog. Trump had another objection to Mueller. "I can't be president," he said. "It's like I have my hands tied behind my back because I can't do anything that looks like it's favorable to Russia or to Putin because of Mueller." West Wingers and those who traveled regularly with Trump noticed that he and Melania seemed to have some sincere affection for each other despite media speculation. But she operated independently. They ate dinner together at times, spent some time together, but they never really seemed to merge their lives. Melania's primary concern was their son, Barron. "She's obsessed with Barron," one person said. "That is her focus, 100%. Trump gave some private advice to a friend who had acknowledged some bad behavior toward women. "Real power is fear. It's all about strength. Never show weakness. You've always got to be strong. Don't be bullied. There is no choice. You've got to deny, 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 and push back on these women," he said. "If you admit to anything and any culpability, then you're dead. That was a big mistake you made. You didn't come out guns blazing and just challenge them. You showed weakness. You've got to be strong. You've got to be aggressive. You've got to push back hard. You've got to deny anything that's said about you. Never admit." Trump debated tariffs for months. He wanted to impose a 25% tariff on auto imports. "I want an executive order," he said. He did not have the legal authority to do that, Porter said. "Fine, we'll challenge it in court, but I don't care. Let's just do it." Another time, the president told Porter, "Go down to your office right now. Get it all written up. Bring me my tariffs." One day in the Oval Office, Cohn brought in the latest job numbers to Trump and Pence. "I have the most perfect job numbers you're ever going to see," Cohn said. "It's all because of my tariffs," Trump said. "They're working." Trump had yet to impose any tariffs, but he believed they were a good idea and knew Cohn disagreed with him. "You're a fucking asshole," Cohn said, half-joking and smacking Trump gently on the arm. Cohn turned to a Secret Service agent. "I just hit the president. If you want to shoot me, go ahead." Cohn wrote a joke for Trump to use at the gridiron dinner. "We've made enormous progress on the wall. All the drawings are done. All the excavating's done. All the engineering is done. The only thing we've been stumbling with is we haven't been able to figure out how to stretch the word Trump over 1,200 miles. Trump wouldn't use it. Porter observed that any time anybody challenged Trump in a policy debate, in court, in the public square, his natural instinct seemed to be that if he was not exerting strength, he was failing. He stopped counting the times that Trump vented about Sessions. His anger never went away. Sessions' recusal was a wound that remained open. Jeff Sessions, Trump said in one of many versions, was an abject failure. He was not loyal. If he had any balls, if he had been a strong guy, he would have just said, "I'm not going to recuse. I'm the Attorney General. I can do whatever I want." Chapter 22. Within the intelligence and military world, there exist what President Obama once told me are our deep secrets. These are matters so sensitive, involving sources and methods, that only a handful of people, including the president and key military and intelligence officials, know about them. After the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the American espionage establishment ballooned, making secret surveillance a way of life. Near the end of May 2017, I learned of one such deep secret. North Korea was accelerating both its missile and nuclear weapons programs at an astonishing rate, and would, well within a year, have a ballistic missile with a nuclear weapon that perhaps could reach the United States mainland. Previously, the intelligence showed North Korea would not have that capability for at least 2 years, if not longer. This new intelligence was a rare earthquake in the intelligence world, but it did not travel far. It was to be protected at almost any cost. In response, a preliminary top-secret Pentagon war plan called for the United States to send escalation signals to put the country on a war footing, reinforce the Korean Peninsula with 2 or 3 aircraft carriers, keep more U.S. Navy attack submarines in the region, capable of firing barrages of Tomahawk missiles, add another squadron of F-22s and more B-2 stealth bombers, perhaps even withdraw U.S. dependents, family members of the 28,500 U.S. military in South Korea, add more ground forces, thicken the theater missile defense systems, disperse troops to make them less vulnerable, harden infrastructure to help withstand artillery attacks. I began checking around about whether North Korea was well within a year of a new ICBM nuclear weapon capability. At the top levels of the Pentagon, I was told, "There is nothing like that," providing an absolute knockdown of my information. At the top levels of the intelligence community, I was told, "There was nothing new and no significant change in the 2-year-plus assessment. There was nothing to be alarmed about." I talked with a person with the broadest, most authoritative access to such current intelligence. The absolute denials were repeated emphatically, categorically. Then something happened that had never occurred in 46 years of reporting. This person said, "If I am wrong, I will apologize to you." That was definitely a first, but the meaning was unclear. "I have had officials lie outright about something very sensitive. Asked later, they have said they felt it was better to dissemble. Why agree to talk or meet? Silence could be interpreted as confirmation," they usually replied. That is the real world of reporting on sensitive intelligence matters. The offer to apologize if wrong had never happened before to me. I decided not to seek out the person to get the apology, but I was soon entitled to one. Just over a month later, on July 3rd, North Korea successfully tested its first ICBM, a Hwasong-14. The missile only traveled 930 kilometers and was in the air only 37 minutes, but the intelligence showed that with a flatter trajectory, it could possibly have reached the United States mainland. This was what my source had warned about 2 months earlier. Trump was briefed that night. The next day, July 4th, he hosted an Independence Day celebration at the White House. That afternoon, McMaster chaired an emergency principals meeting in the Situation Room. Trump was not present. CIA Director Pompeo said there was confirmation of an ICBM. It had been fired via an 8-axle mobile vehicle that had been imported from China. So much for the hope that China would be a restraining influence on North Korea. Tillerson said he had been unable to contact the Chinese, but had called for an emergency meeting in the UN Security Council. "We need to work with Russia to get their support and focus on countries that are not abiding by the existing sanctions," he said. "This ought to be a topic of discussion at the G20, especially with Japan and the Republic of Korea." Tillerson raised the concern that the administration was targeting China with steel tariffs at a time when they needed its help to corral North Korea. He was also worried about allies' reactions to Trump's threatened steel tariffs, like Japan, South Korea, and the European Union. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley said, "China has been avoiding us, but eventually they agreed to a UN Security Council meeting tomorrow." The U.S. needed to identify more companies who did business with North Korea for additional sanctions. "We need a persuasive press statement to gain allies on this," Mattis said. "We don't want to show any daylight between us and the Republic of Korea." He walked through military contingency plans, including possible strikes in North Korea, the full range from limited pinpoints to an all-out attack and even a leadership strike. The U.S. didn't have all of the ships and other assets it might need in the region. They were not ready for every contingency, and it would take time to get everything in line. "Our first choice ought to be UN-led sanctions," Mnuchin said. "Otherwise, we can have another dozen primary sanctions available." Mike Rogers, NSA director, outlined the United States' defensive posture on cybersecurity. He did not address offensive cyber attack capabilities. "There really ought to be a question of how much technical data we share with China and Russia," cautioned DNI Dan Coates, "in terms of what we picked up about the ICBM and other things. U.S. intelligence had a pretty full picture, and it had to be protected." "We're going to find out pretty soon here whether China is with us as promised," said Tillerson. If the United States was ready to impose a ban on American citizens traveling to North Korea, we ought to get other countries to do the same. "The big challenge is going to be the loss of human intelligence," Pompeo said, alluding to a possible impact on sensitive CIA sources. "I hope we go slow on this," said Mattis. He knew the details of the special access programs. That loss of human intelligence would be a big thing. "Continued travel poses the risk of hostage-taking," Tillerson said, but he did not disagree with Pompeo and Mattis about the importance of the human sources. The consensus was that without taking bold action, the U.S. risked being seen as tepid and lacking in the new normal of an ICBM-equipped North Korea. North Korea's missile launch was a full-scale crisis. Kim Jong-un now had mobile ICBM capability and missiles that could potentially reach the homeland. U.S. intelligence had incontrovertible evidence that the Chinese had supplied the 8-axle vehicle that was a key component of these complex missile systems. The CIA risked losing sensitive sources if the U.S. tightened travel restrictions, and if the president decided to order some sort of significant military response, the assets would not be immediately available. I later learned that the person I had spoken to in May believed the information to be so sensitive, it had been decided that it was better to lie. Less than 2 months later, September 3rd, North Korea conducted an underground test of its most powerful nuclear weapon, its sixth. This was at least 17 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima in 1945. During the campaign on February 10, 2016, Trump said on CBS This Morning he would get China to make Kim disappear in one form or another very quickly. He called Kim a bad dude, and don't underestimate him. An executive order signed in 1981 by President Reagan stated, "No person employed by or acting on behalf of the U.S. government shall engage in or conspire to engage in assassination." But government lawyers had concluded that a military strike on a leader's command and control headquarters during hostilities would not violate the assassination ban. One of the early applications of leader command and control targeting occurred near the end of the Clinton presidency. The military strike is little remembered because it came in the midst of the congressional debate on the impeachment of the president. In December 1998, Clinton ordered a military strike in Iraq. The Desert Fox operation included 650 bomber or missile sorties against fewer than 100 targets over 3 days. It was billed as a large bombing attack to punish Iraq for failing to allow United Nations weapons inspectors to search for weapons of mass destruction. Desert Fox was not explicitly designed to kill Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, but fully half the targets were his palaces or other locations he might use that were protected by special intelligence and Republican Guard units. Saddam was not hit, though many in the administration, particularly Secretary of Defense William Cohen, had hoped it would be the end of him. In the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, President George W. Bush and his national security officials again pondered whether it was possible to kill Saddam through covert action. CIA officers in the Demoralized Iraqi Operations Group, often referred to within the agency and among themselves as the House of Broken Toys, gave a dramatic no. It would be too hard. Saddam was too well protected. The security and intelligence organizations existed to keep him alive and in power. The operations group posed a military invasion as the only way to remove the dictator. On the eve of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, CIA human sources, codenamed Rockstars, reported with increasing certainty that Saddam was at Dora Farm, a complex southeast of Baghdad on the banks of the Tigris River. Told that Saddam was holed up in a bunker, Bush ordered a strike with bunker-busting bombs. Hours later, CIA Director George Tenet called the Situation Room. "Tell the president we got the son of a bitch." They had not. Days later, the CIA base chief in northern Iraq visited Dora Farm, which looked like the ruins of a flea market. He found no bunker, just a subterranean pantry for food storage. One thing was clear. Saddam had escaped, or he had never been there. He was captured 9 months later when U.S. forces found him hiding in a spider hole under a small shack. The CIA engaged in some high-level introspection over the next several years. Officials asked the crucial after-action question. Suppose Saddam had been killed by covert action or military strike. Would that have made the invasion and long war unnecessary? The cost in lives included more than 100,000 Iraqis by conservative count and 4,530 Americans. The U.S. cost was at least $800 billion and probably $1 trillion. How much Middle East instability did the war cause and enable Iran? The Middle East and world history seemed to pivot around the Iraq War for years. This self-examination peaked years later during the time John Brennan was CIA director, 2013 to early 2017. An agency man to the core with a smooth, confident, and austere manner, he had vast CIA experience and a track record for being right. On television, he rarely smiled. Brennan had been daily intelligence briefer for President Clinton, CIA station chief in Saudi Arabia, executive assistant and chief of staff to CIA Director Tenet. As the White House counterterrorism chief in Obama's first term, he had developed a strong relationship with the president, who rewarded him with the CIA directorship in his second term. Brennan was known as the answer man. He read deeply in the intelligence reports, often asking to see agent reports and raw communications intercepts. Mindful of the Iraq mistake, Brennan ultimately concluded that the CIA had not done its job. The House of Broken Toys had dodged its responsibilities, insisting, "You need troops! You need troops!" Well, that was not the CIA's job. Their energy could better have been focused on what the CIA could do to present options. Given the magnitude of the mistake, Brennan concluded that the Saddam problem could have been solved with what he called indirect assassination. So as the North Korean problem escalated during the Obama presidency, Brennan developed an aggressive argument. The CIA should not seek regime change, but man change, the elimination of leader Kim Jong-un. Brennan concluded the Iraq Operations Group of the pre-invasion period of 2002 to 2003 had little guts, know-how, and imagination. So the equivalent group for North Korea in the CIA Operations Directorate went to work. Was indirect assassination or man change possible? It was an option worth examining. The CIA's North Korea group came up with the Peninsula Intelligence Estimate, PI, which would provide warnings that the North was going to initiate an attack. The Pentagon's top-secret contingency U.S. war plan, the response to an attack, was for regime change in North Korea and was called Op Plan 5027. A tasking order assigned targets and missions of the air, naval, and land forces. It was a massive plan designed to win the war and one of the most sensitive in the U.S. government. The time-phased force deployment, TIPFID, showed that it would take 30 days to get all the forces in. A simpler but vastly more risky option included strikes at the North Korean leadership targets, specifically Kim Jong-un, under a more refined war plan, Op Plan 5015. The Air Force had several leadership attack options, including sending a stealth bomber attack in and out of North Korea before North Korea could do anything about it. This would require knowledge with great clarity, as one general put it, to execute a pinpoint attack on leadership. From October 17th to 19th, 2017, the U.S. Air Force ran an elaborate series of simulated airstrikes in the Missouri Ozarks. The region has a similar topography to North Korea. The encrypted communications system between the bombers, the airborne early warning aircraft, and the tankers was not working, so the pilots' communications were heard by locals who monitored the military frequencies. One communication referred to a possible DPRK, North Korea, leadership relocation site. In another, the pilot referred to a command post possible DPRK leadership relocation site. One airdrop exercise was from just 150 meters, which is dangerously low but designed for maximum underground destruction. In another related exercise, the bomber carried a 30,000-pound MOP, massive ordnance penetrator, the type used earlier in Afghanistan in April 2017. In the exercise simulations, the map coordinates pinpointed a hangar at a Jefferson City airport. The pilots also discussed the timing of the bomb fuses to maximize impact on the targets. By any reasoning, the exercise was serious preparation, but it was at this point one available contingency on the shelf being practiced. McMaster sounded hawkish on North Korea, arguing internally in the White House that if Trump was going to attack, better to go early before the North improved its missiles and nuclear weapons. Or before it built more. Time would make the threat greater. To those less inclined, McMaster asked, "Do you want to bet a mushroom cloud over Los Angeles over it?" This question echoed the pre-Iraq invasion comment of Condoleezza Rice, Bush's national security advisor, that it was uncertain how quickly Saddam could acquire nuclear weapons. She added, "But we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud." General Kelly, the Homeland Security Secretary and retired four-star Marine general, was furious when he learned that the White House was working on a compromise on immigration for Dreamers, a central issue in the immigration debate. Dreamers are immigrant children brought to the United States by their parents who, as adults, had entered illegally. Under the 2012 legislation called DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, President Obama had given 800,000 Dreamers protection from deportation and made work permits available to them, hoping to bring them out of the shadow economy and give them an American identity. Kelly, a hardliner on immigration, was supposed to be in charge of these matters now, but Jared Kushner had been working a back-channel compromise. He had been inviting Senator Dick Durbin, the Illinois Democrat who was number two in his party's leadership, and Lindsey Graham to his office to discuss a compromise. Graham later asked Kelly, "Didn't Jared tell you we've been working on this for months? We've got a fix." Kelly called Bannon. "If the son-in-law is going to run it, then have the son-in-law run it. I don't need to run it. I need to come see the president. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not going to be up there and be blindsided and humiliated on something that I've got to be in the loop on." Bannon believed the administration owned the hard-line immigration posture, except for Trump himself. "He's always been soft on DACA. He believes the left-wing thing. They're all valedictorians. They're all Rhodes scholars. Because Ivanka, over the years, has told him that." Kelly voiced his distress to Priebus, who, along with Bannon, feared Kelly might quit. "Get Kelly some time on the calendar," Bannon proposed. "Let him come see the boss and light Jared up, because this is Jared's shit, doing stuff behind people's back." Priebus didn't do it. "Get it on the fucking calendar," Bannon insisted. Priebus continued to stall. It would expose disorganization in the White House. "What are you talking about?" Bannon asked. This was laughable. Of course Priebus didn't have control of Jared, and people were always going behind someone's back. So, Bannon and Priebus both told Kelly, "We'll take care of it." To go to the president would cause unnecessary consternation. "We'll make sure it won't happen again, and you're going to be in the loop." Kelly, team player for the moment, didn't push it further. When he later mentioned it obliquely in the president's presence, Trump didn't respond. Lindsey Graham wandered into Bannon's West Wing office. "Hey, here's the deal. You want your wall?" Trump would get wall funding in exchange for the Dreamers. "Stop," Bannon said. "A deal on the Dreamers was amnesty. We will never give amnesty for one person. I don't care if you build 10 fucking walls. The wall ain't good enough. It's got to be chain migration." Chain migration, formerly called the Family Reunification Policy, allowed a single legal immigrant to bring close family members into the United States, parents, children, a spouse, and in some cases, siblings. These family members would have a path to legal permanent residency or citizenship. They might be followed by a chain of their own spouses, children, parents, or siblings. 2/3, 68%, of legal permanent residents entered under family reunification or chain migration in 2016. This was at the heart of Trump's and Bannon's anti-immigration stance. They wanted to stop illegal immigration and limit legal immigration. Bannon wanted a new, stricter policy. Graham and he were not able to come close to agreement. Ivanka and Jared invited Stephen Miller, the hardliner on immigration, to their house for dinner along with Durbin and Graham. "All you do is listen," Bannon instructed Miller. "Just go and receive. Don't fight them. I just want to hear it all." Miller reported that Ivanka and Jared thought they had Trump on some sort of deal that included funding for the wall in exchange for amnesty for 1.8 million Dreamers. Bannon figured chain migration made the real number double or triple that, 3 to 5 million new immigrants. "They can't think we're that dumb." Some days, it seemed to Bannon that Senator Graham had moved into the West Wing. He heard his pitch on Dreamers at least 3 times. He thought that Graham wanted to replace McConnell as majority leader. Bannon was at the height of his war with McConnell and saw Graham as his biggest ally. Graham and Bannon were on the phone nearly every day. Bannon believed everyone hated McConnell and wanted to put the shiv to him because he ran things too tight. Graham did talk about finding a replacement for McConnell. "We've got to find our guy who'll replace him," Graham said. But Graham denied he wanted McConnell's leadership job. Bannon believed Graham was the best dealmaker for Republicans, but he was the establishment. Graham didn't like Bannon's nationalist agenda, telling him, "Bannon, that America First is bullshit. This is all bullshit." In the true and practiced Trump White House style, Bannon was willing to ride any horse to achieve his purposes. He called Attorney General Sessions to the White House. Their problem on immigration was now Trump. "He's going to be listening to Jared and Ivanka, and Graham is the best salesman around there. He loves Graham. Graham can sell him anything. He's got Durbin. They're going to be loving up on him. We've got a fucking problem." Bannon spoke with Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, one of the biggest opponents of the Dreamers and a hero of the right. Kobach's idea was that he and other state attorneys general would file suit claiming DACA was unconstitutional. Bannon and Sessions developed a plan not to defend the lawsuit. "It's over," Bannon said. "DACA's finished." All Trump had to say to Congress was, "Hey, I work at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. If you've got an idea, come up and see me." Trump only had to stay neutral. Chapter 23. As Trump was laying plans to withdraw from the Paris Accord on climate change, Priebus had it with Ivanka. The president's 35-year-old daughter and White House senior advisor effectively had free run of the West Wing. She had launched what amounted to a covert operation in support of the Paris Accord, a non-binding international agreement to address climate change by voluntarily cutting greenhouse gas emissions that was reached in 2015 and involved 195 countries. Obama had pledged to cut these emissions about 25% below the levels in 2005. This would be accomplished by 2025. He had committed $3 billion to aid underdeveloped countries in a green climate fund. Only $1 billion had been paid, and Obama had transferred half of that 3 days before he left office. Ivanka strongly wanted her father to stick with the pro-environmental agreement. Priebus would be meeting in his office with a handful of aides from the economic team and the National Economic Council for 15 minutes, and in would walk Ivanka. She would sit down and often say nothing. "Who is this person?" Priebus marveled. "What is she doing?" It was becoming impossible to manage the West Wing. At times, it seemed Ivanka's presence, hours a day, days in a row, was nonstop. Jared had the same squatter's rights in the West Wing. They were like a posse of second-guessers, hovering, watching, interacting as family and senior advisors with the president. Ivanka planted seeds of doubt about policy and passed her father articles. When Priebus voiced his dismay, Trump regularly joked, "They're Democrats." They were New Yorkers infected with the liberalism of their city roots. The president made no real effort to curtail their freelancing. Priebus believed he had run a very tight and organizationally sound Republican National Committee. The Trump White House seemed designed to upend any order or routine. At one point, Priebus had a decision memo for the president to review and sign on the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Agreement. Ivanka said to her father, "Mark Zuckerberg wants to talk to you." She had lined up a call between her father and the founder and CEO of Facebook. Zuckerberg was an outspoken climate change advocate. She did the same with Tim Cook, the Apple CEO, and others. At one point, she slipped a personal message from former Vice President Al Gore, one of the foremost Paris advocates, into a stack of papers on the president's desk. Trump talked to Gore, who reported to others that he actually thought Trump seemed like he might stay in. Ivanka and Jared gave a newspaper story to the president with highlighted quotes from an unnamed White House source. "You know who this is? This is Steve Bannon," they said. In a West Wing filled with leakers, These tactics slowly but surely planted a distrust of Bannon with the president. Porter noticed Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, in the West Wing lobby on April 5th. He had been Pruitt's Sherpa when Pruitt was barely confirmed by the Senate, 52-46. Pruitt had been Oklahoma Attorney General for 6 years, where he ran a war against EPA regulations. They made small talk. When Pruitt walked down to the Oval Office, Porter followed. Pruitt was not on the regular schedule. This was clearly an off-the-books meeting. That was evident when Bannon showed up in the Oval Office. "We need to get out of Paris," Pruitt said, handing the president a plain sheet of paper he wanted him to read, withdrawing from the Paris Accord. "We need to get out," he said. "This was a campaign commitment." "Yes, yes, yes," Bannon said several times. "We've got to do this now." "Make this statement," Pruitt said. "This could be your press statement. Maybe read it to reporters in the Oval Office and have the press secretary put it out as a written statement." Porter was taken aback. As staff secretary, he knew there had been no process. No one had been consulted. There had been no legal review. Pruitt and Bannon had snuck into the Oval Office and wanted an instant decision on the major international and national environmental issue of the day. Porter knew the paper on the president's desk was incendiary. Trump could pick it up, decide to read it out loud to the press, or take it to Press Secretary Sean Spicer and say, "Put this out." When he had a chance, Porter took Pruitt's draft statement from Trump's desk. Later, he told Bannon and Pruitt they could not just walk into the Oval Office this way. It was a huge process foul. It was unacceptable. Gary Cohn gathered the principals for a meeting on the Paris Agreement in the Situation Room on April 27th. Cohn's National Economic Council had sent around a "for official use only" 6-page memo proposing two options. The first was to withdraw from Paris. The second was, "remain in the Paris Agreement, but adopt a pledge that does not harm the economy and puts a hold on further financial commitments and contributions." "I want to turn first to the White House counsel," Cohn said, opening the meeting, "to walk us through some of the legal issues." But Don McGahn was not there. His deputy, Greg Katsas, discussed technical issues until McGahn arrived. "Great, McGahn's here," Cohn said. "Tee up the legal issues for us." McGahn supported getting out, though he had not yet revealed his hand. "Well," he said, "we're going to have these court cases. And if we don't get out of Paris, then it's really going to jeopardize some of the regulatory rollback that we're likely to do at EPA. Paris was one of the justifications the Obama administration used as part of the regulatory record to justify the cost and benefits of the Clean Power Plan. That was an Obama-era 460-page rule to lower carbon dioxide emitted by power plants that the EPA estimated would save 4,500 lives a year. Pruitt was already moving to end the policy. "So unless we exit Paris, all of these sorts of cases are going to be in jeopardy," McGahn said. He was for getting out immediately. "You don't know what you're talking about," Tillerson said. "My State Department legal advisor, which was the office that negotiated this in the first place and has the relevant expertise, says we can't just announce that we are getting out." The option paper clearly said the United States cannot officially announce a withdrawal from the Paris Agreement until November 2019, 2.5 years away. But the second option, remaining in the accord but doing nothing that harmed the economy and putting a hold on further financial contributions, would put the U.S. in good stead in terms of litigation, Tillerson said. The Secretary of State stood alone. Pruitt spoke strongly for getting out. Priebus, who saw the political benefits, was for getting out. Bannon saw Paris as one more globalist deal that screwed the United States. At the end, Cohn said they obviously needed to get the legal issues squared away. "But I think we're starting to get a consensus." He was right. Paris was dead. McMaster and Porter huddled before a 10 a.m. June 1st meeting with the president in the Oval Office on the Paris Accord. Trump was due to make an announcement that day. "We've got to make a last-ditch effort," they agreed. "Withdrawing will damage our relationships with so many other countries," McMaster said. He was inundated with calls from his counterparts. "You guys aren't really thinking about doing this, are you?" Or, more explicitly, "Please don't do this." Porter had drafted some language for the president to use. "The United States will withdraw from the terms of the Paris Climate Accord, effective immediately." Porter read his proposal. "As of today, the United States will not adhere to any financial or economic burden the Paris Accord purports to impose, including its nationally determined contribution." Withdrawing from the terms would technically leave the United States in the accord. "This will read like it's tough enough," Porter argued to McMaster. "He'll feel like he's getting the political bang for the buck. He'll be fulfilling the campaign promise. It'll excite the base." It was basically option two from the principals' meeting, remain in the Paris Accord. Porter thought he had found a way to minimize the damage. Porter and McMaster presented the proposed language to the president. They talked until they were blue in the face, but it was clear they'd lost the fight. "No, no, no," Trump said. He was withdrawing full scale. "That's the only way that I can be true to my base." As Trump worked over the speech draft, he toughened the language further. In a late afternoon Rose Garden appearance that day that included a brass band, the president praised the stock market and U.S. efforts to fight terrorism. "On these issues and so many more, we're following through on our commitments, and I don't want anything to get in our way." Then, unburying the lead, he said, "Therefore, in order to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens, the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. As someone who cares deeply about the environment, which I do, I cannot in good conscience support a deal that punishes the United States, which is what it does, the world's leader in environmental protection, while imposing no meaningful obligations on the world's leading polluters. I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris." On June 15, 2017, The Washington Post ran a story by three of its top Justice Department and FBI reporters headlined, "Special Counsel is Investigating Jared Kushner's Business Dealings." Mueller wanted more and more records. Kushner hired Abby Lowell, a top Washington criminal defense lawyer. Priebus could see the fires building around a string of troubled investments Jared was involved in. He decided to escalate, make a big play. He told Trump that Jared should not be in the White House in an official capacity. Nepotism laws existed for a reason. The Mueller investigation was going deeply into Jared's finances, and it will jump to your finances if it hasn't already. Normally, Trump would ignore or dismiss. This time he paused, slowed down, and became reflective. He looked at his chief of staff. The response was jarring, so different. "You're right," the president said. Priebus continued to tell Trump that as his son-in-law, Jared should not have an official position and office in the White House. But this suggestion would ricochet right back and get him in trouble with Jared, who wanted to stay. Jared remained a mission Priebus failed to accomplish. Having failed in efforts to control or curtail the president's tweeting, Priebus searched for a way to have practical impact. Since the tweets were often triggered by the president's obsessive TV watching, he looked for ways to shut off the television. But television was Trump's default activity. Sunday nights were often the worst. Trump would come back to the White House from the weekend at one of his golf resorts just in time to catch political talk on his enemy networks, MSNBC and CNN. The president and the first lady had separate bedrooms in the residence. Trump had a giant TV going much of the time, alone in his bedroom with the clicker, the TiVo, and his Twitter account. Priebus called the presidential bedroom the devil's workshop, and the early mornings and dangerous Sunday nights the witching hour. There was not much he could do about the mornings, but he had some control over the weekend schedule. He started scheduling Trump's Sunday returns to the White House later in the afternoon. Trump would get to the White House just before 9 p.m., when MSNBC and CNN generally turned to softer programming that did not focus on the immediate political controversies and Trump's inevitable role in them. Bannon realized that the cascade of NSC presentations about Afghanistan, Iran, China, Russia, and North Korea was not really connecting with Trump. Without some organizing principle, it was too much for his attention span. So he called Sally Donnelly, a key close advisor to Secretary Mattis. "Sally, you've got to talk to your boss. Here's the problem. One day the focus was Libya. The next, it might be Syria. I know this guy. He's frustrated. It's too disjointed. Besides what we are doing with the Saudis, everything else is kind of hodgepodge. I've got something I want to talk to Mattis about, and I'll bring it over and diagram it for him." Bannon had come up with what he called the strategy of the United States. At 8 a.m. on a June Saturday, Bannon arrived at the Pentagon. He had coffee with Donnelly and Mattis's chief of staff, retired Rear Admiral Kevin Sweeney. They then gathered with Mattis around the small conference table in the secretary's office. "Here's my problem," Bannon said. "You guys haven't thought about the Pacific at all. You haven't thought about China. There's no in-depth. You are so tied to CENTCOM, the central command that covered the Middle East and South Asia." Since Mattis had been the CENTCOM commander from 2010 to 2013, Bannon thought that Mattis had brought that mindset to the job of Secretary of Defense. He reminded Mattis that Chinese policy leaders and intellectuals were split on their views of the United States. One group saw the U.S. as an equal partner, a co-hegemon. The other, the hawks, looked at the United States as a lesser power and treated it like one. Mattis countered. Annihilating ISIS was the assignment President Trump had specifically given him. "I'll basically cut a deal with you," Bannon proposed. "If Mattis would support the containment of China, he would back off on the pressure to get the U.S. out of Afghanistan." Afghanistan was a linchpin on the Chinese One Belt, One Road plan to expand its trading network to Europe. "Steve," Mattis said, "I'm kind of one of those global trading guys. I think all that trade stuff's pretty good." Bannon was appalled. Trump was right. The generals didn't know anything about business and economics. They never really cared about the cost of anything. Chapter 24. Over the weekend of July 8th and 9th, the New York Times published two stories about a previously undisclosed meeting in Trump Tower in the middle of the campaign. Don Trump Jr., Manafort, and Kushner had met with a Russian lawyer who, among other things, was offering dirt on Hillary Clinton. There were the usual denials, restatements, and confusion among the participants. It was a huge story, suggesting, but not proving, some kind of subterfuge and clandestine cooperation with Russians. The president was in orbit and called Dowd to complain about leaks and the press. "Mr. President, it's horseshit," Dowd told him. "And so what? Getting dirt on people was commonplace in campaigns and the nation's capital. It even had a name, opposition research or investigative reporting. That's what half of Washington seems to be paid for. Is there something wrong with that?" No. Dowd knew that opposition research teams and investigative reporters would take dirt from anyone, even foreign governments. All the media posturing was disgusting. They were treating it like the crime of the century. The New York Times and the Washington Post thought they were the special counsel and the law of the land. The stories were a big nothing burger, Dowd concluded. On July 17th, Trump tweeted, Most politicians would have gone to a meeting like the one Don Jr. attended in order to get info on an opponent. That's politics. Dowd was determined not to be distracted by the daily drip from the media. He wanted hard evidence. McGahn religiously dictated all significant meetings or discussions with the president to his executive assistant, Annie Donaldson. She had 17 hours of notes relating to matters being investigated by Mueller and his team. Dowd gave Mueller these notes and those of 7 other lawyers. Nothing was held back. He told Mueller, "Bob, read Annie Donaldson's notes if you want to know what was in the head of the president." All this was done with the president's blessing. Dowd would talk to him and say, "Look, here's the categories of documents. We're going to give him this. We're going to give him that. Constitutionally, he has no right to the documents and testimony, but just out of respect for law enforcement, since you're the chief, let's just let him do it. Not get in the fight." Dowd concluded that the president seemed fearless. He never said no. Dowd told Mueller, "This is what I told the president, so don't make me look like an idiot, okay? And we're going to make you look good. You make us look good. But you've got to get it done." Mueller received 1.4 million pages of documents from the Trump campaign and 20,000 pages from the White House. Dowd believed no documents had been destroyed. In all, 37 witnesses gave interviews to Mueller's team voluntarily. McGahn, Priebus, and the vice president's staff had put together a 6-page White House summary of the entire Flynn matter from contemporaneous recollections. Dowd considered it the Bible on Flynn and delivered it to Mueller. He believed that no one other than Flynn had lied to investigators, and Mueller had not needed to pressure or jam anyone. When Dowd was sending the campaign records to the Congressional Investigating Committee, he told Mueller's deputy Quarles, "We're sending copies to the Hill. How about if I just deliver a copy to you?" Quarles accepted. Dowd thought he and Quarles worked well together. They could meet and talk, whereas Mueller was so rigid he sometimes seemed like marble. On July 20th, Bloomberg dropped an apparent bombshell. Mueller was investigating Trump's finances, including Russian purchases of apartments in Trump buildings, the 2013 Miss Universe pageant in Moscow, and Trump's sale of a Florida mansion to a Russian oligarch in 2008. Dowd called Quarles to ask about the story. "Well," Quarles said, "Bob never comments." "Give me a break, pal," Dowd replied angrily. "I'm taking care of you, now you take care of me." As they both knew, a denial from the White House doesn't get anywhere. Dowd continued, "The deal was with you guys, if you guys added to the investigation, we'd get a heads up first." "That's right. Because you gave us the subjects to cover," Dowd said. "And every once in a while, you guys add things and we put it on a list. I didn't hear about condos in Florida or selling this estate." Dowd said he was aware of some matters under investigation in New York about Trump lawyer Michael Cohen and Felix Sater, who tried to develop a Trump tower in Moscow. "You know, Jimmy," Dowd added, "when you ask me a question, I give it all to you. So I need a better explanation." "John, let me put it this way," Quarles said. "I'm 99% sure that it's not us." "I got it," Dowd said. He immediately called the president, knowing when that kind of story broke, Trump could not focus on anything else. Trump was apoplectic. "They're not investigating that stuff," Dowd said, trying to reassure him. But Trump was not trusting at all and sounded like he could find no comfort. 4 days later, Dowd met Quarles on a stone bench outside the Patriot Plaza where Mueller had his offices. "Bob and I owe you one," Quarles said. "Bob says don't believe what you read in the papers." "I got it," Dowd replied. "We are really embarrassed," Quarles said. "Why?" "You've delivered more than you promised, and we're so pleased. We're moving along. We're getting it done. And there's a lot of stuff here to organize, but it came very well organized. We didn't have to go hunt and peck. You didn't drown us. Dowd knew about a target of a tax investigation who had once told the FBI that the answer to their request was somewhere in two warehouses. The agent